Pepperdine and then graduated and stayed
Okay, that
downtown.
Was a really great test. Oh. This shows you how good I am. I wasn't even recording.
Perfect. Perfect test.
That was great. That's embarrassing.
No, okay. That was perfect.
What's up, everybody? Joshua Thomas Gray here with another episode of We Are Human. We're just kind of talking about how I have not recorded a podcast in like 6 months because, well, if you haven't noticed, a lot of things are happening in the world. And I kind of took a pause to all my content creation for a little bit. Yeah, and then we were talking about how something we do want to talk about is obviously the Black Lives Movement and how I feel like I don't hear many people talking about it. I'm here with my friend Kyland, and we're just going to hang out, talk, hear about your life. So go ahead.
Love it.
Know who you are.
Yeah, like you said, I'm Kyland Young. I grew up in Southern California, like in the desert in between LA and Vegas, a pretty like flyover town that's just... like the high desert area is what it's called, and it's about 2 hours northeast of here. And I've been in LA since 2009. So I came out of college out here and was studying a lot of, like, communications and social action and justice and conflict resolution and all these things that ended up becoming more and more relevant. My background ended up in marketing and then ended up helping start a company sign on as a founder for this company with a friend of mine. We were able to do a pretty successful exit from that company, and then I was doing some nonprofit stuff and just have been really fortunate to like work with all these really cool brands doing really cool things, and I've always kind of found myself at that intersection of doing really cool fun things and then also trying to leave the world better than I found it, some sort of impact, some sort of positive thing. So where I found myself for a while, I was like working with nonprofits and then doing a lot of consulting for nonprofits. Like, how do I bring these big ideas that we're working on for Red Bull and Nike and Microsoft and Beats by Dre that we were working on for those accounts? Like, how do we bring those to, you know, a smaller nonprofit that's trying to get off the ground? They want to be a Charity Water or one of these other organizations. And then the more then I became a board member for a nonprofit called Urban Saddles that helps work with basically kids in like the Compton area. If you've ever seen the Compton Cowboys or any of them, that all came from this place called The Hill. That's like since like the 50s, I want to say, this black cowboy ranch that was in Compton that has given an alternative for a really long time for young, especially black kids in LA, Compton area, to be able to have an alternative, some sort of lifestyle they could pick up as far as... to like potentially gang life or other things that weren't as that, you know, they are more dangerous and less productive and more damaging to in so many ways. So so that's that was
Whoa.
There's this hurricane happening, reporting live. No.
Yeah, we're currently at the Jungle House where you live.
Like, yes,
25 million other people live here, and
it's only 16.
A windstorm just blew through. And there's a creaky... The audio was beautiful just a second ago.
For like an hour. But it's still picking up us. I can talk loud.
Yeah, we're good. It's fine. We both talk loud, so we'll be fine. Just ignore all those sounds. Just pretend we're literally in the jungle.
Exactly. We kind of are. This is like a temporary nickname we call it, like Jungle Beach House. And we're looking into a few names for it. But it definitely is a dope vibe. But yeah, so I've been... So I was working with, I've been on the board for Urban Saddles, and then really this year, like, I've always been involved, like, sometimes, you know, there's a guy named Kendrick Sampson, a big, and an organization called Revolve that helps do some nonprofit things, and so I've had a few meetings with them over the years and, like, have been always interested in figuring out, like, how to have an impact, and then I spent... in last year, the beginning of last year, I was working for a little bit with an organization called Blavity that's like the largest black media company in the world specifically for black millennials, like reaching anywhere from like 30 to 60 million black millennials for the most part. So it's really big audience, really powerful platform that had a lot of impact and really great things. And I loved it. But for just personal professional reasons, I had an offer at a different company that is actually this black owned scholarship company. This kid, not a kid, he's our age, but he started this company to help kids get scholarships. He grew up in like Alabama and ended up getting he won like over $1 million in scholarships himself, and everybody was asking him. So he's like, let me just show people. And he built an app for that. And now we've been able to help get kids over $100 million worth of scholarships over the last, like...
How long have you been there?
I've only been there this year, since a few months, several months. But the company's been around 5 years. Gotcha. And so before that, I was at Blavity. That was the media company. And then from there, so I had that impact that I really liked, but then this impact, just for a variety of reasons, ended. I like the tangible aspect of it, of tracking those dollar amounts, so for that direct impact. And it just... professionally ended up working out really well. So
scholarships in what way? School?
Yeah, or school. Yeah, college scholarships. Yeah. Scholarships for college. So people can basically log on and find, enter in their demographics, enter in their info, and then they'll get like, it just simplifies that search from like days or months to like minutes, like instantly returning those results. Damn. And it helps them edit their essays. It's like a really amazing app. And then now we're actually getting ready. We've really been the soft launch, but we're getting ready for a full wide launch of like a platform, another part of our platform that will help students with college debt. So if they have college debt, which is, you know, the biggest debt in the country and is its own crisis. Yeah. there's ways around it. Like, this industry is so shady. Like, there's so many.
Dude, it's horrible.
It should be criminal, the things they've been able to do. And like myself having, you know, basically like six figures in debt and probably paying double that by the time it's all said and done. Maybe more than double that. And, you know, sometimes at certain months paying for like double rent, essentially paying rent and my college debt was like doubling rent.
Yeah.
So it's just a horrible industry that right now we have a solve for that, because there are ways around it that they've made, but they make it really hard to find it. Yeah. And so we've been able to help like reduce those payments and reduce overall amounts without having to like refinance or go credit checks or anything like that. So Scholly Payoff, I don't know when you're listening, should be available very soon. So that's what we're getting ready to do.
That's available and good for anybody.
Anybody who has debt. Anybody who already graduated, who's already making payments.
Yeah.
So if you are, well, or if you have your deferment, because right now most of the country is in deferment forbearance because of COVID-19 and all the associated financial hardships that's resulted in. But so they're in like this no interest forbearance, which is great. But the way the industry is set up, they're probably going to, as soon as the government stops offering it, these companies will probably still offer it because they know they'll make more money in interest that way.
Right.
So like they know, so like the things they do is very predatory.
Totally.
And not in the interest of the student so often. Right. So like I said, it's amazing that it hasn't been more criminal considered what they do. So
do you think it ever will? Do you think that will ever, or it won't? It'll just
I think
be...
we discovered in 2008 that it probably won't.
Right. Because it's like we all know.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, that's a surprise. You're charging an exorbitant amount of money to, and
for this more necessary, less valuable thing.
Right.
It's the craziest.
So we kind of just go with it.
Yeah. And I think they will. Something's got to give because it's very unsustainable long term.
Right.
Like I said, I mean, past mortgage debt in America. And so like, and like the fact that the college degrees are becoming more valuable and less valuable, but more expensive.
Right.
Is just not a recipe for disaster. Like it has to give at some point. I don't know what that would be like, but for right now we're like, well, we can help do this. So we can help reduce your payments, help for in some cases get you forgiveness. So like that's a new service that we are getting ready to launch wide in these next couple of weeks. So before the end of the year it should be, because we're at the end of October now. So
really excited. That's awesome. also, holy crap, you already went through so many different things. Like, oh my gosh, what? One question, because it kind of seems like everything you've already done from the start sounds like you really were wanting to do meaningful work. Is that true? At like, were you pretty young when you were like, I want to do stuff that matters?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, like, I don't know how much of that came from home. My parents have always been, my mom especially has always been very like positive. Like, she was always volunteering for to help out like her kids, anything she could do. Like, she was volunteering at the school. She literally like got her own bought rope from the store, bought an orange vest, and like set up the rope to like block off cars from coming into where the kids would get on the buses at school. Yeah. And like, so she did that on her own, and they're like, we should probably make this a position. So they end up like turning that into an actual position and like hiring somebody to do that. But like, she's always been very proactive in terms of like helping, like, especially anything involving her kids. But like for us, that, you know, she was helping all the kids that way. And that translated really well for us. I say us because I have four sisters. Cool.
No brothers.
No brothers. Just one older sister, three younger. All incredible. All of them close. So very fortunate in that way. Close to all my parents because my mom got remarried. So I have my mom, my stepdad, and my dad and my stepmom. Close to all of them. So very fortunate. I don't know where, if it came from that or really early on, you know, mentors like... mentors from afar, I think about like Will Smith became like an idol for me really young. And it was mostly like, I mean, I loved his movies, and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was like my favorite show, but it was, I remember like the biggest like monument to my first like personal development, like entry was like some Will Smith interview where he was talking about like I want the world to be better because I was here. And that became like a mantra, like an ethos for me, like a purpose that I try and live
by. How old do you remember when that was? Like, were you in high school?
I was in high school, for sure. Maybe like 15 or 14, I don't know. So I'm probably in that range, I'd guess. At oldest, like 15 or 14.
Right.
But it just stuck with me. And I don't know, that's kind of a lens that I've tried to operate out of.
Right.
When I was at my first like longer term job was at this marketing agency called B Corp that was the dopest like work ever, like super stoked on it. And so that one, we weren't necessarily doing anything of this work, but like it was a great environment, amazing people I worked with. We were doing like the sickest projects, like breaking world records all the time for brands, and like doing, you know, the coolest stunts and everything. So it was amazing. And just getting to think on that high level for these brands was really exciting, and all skills that I, you know, was able to take with me and find out. But during that time, I was still like, you know, I would still volunteer with, there's a guy, a mentor of mine, named Tom Shadyac. He's a filmmaker. He wrote and directed like a lot of old school comedies like Nutty Professor, Bruce Almighty, Liar Liar, Ace Ventura. Like, he was a big time Hollywood guy that literally, he ended up, years before I met him, he changed his life and was just like, you know what, this isn't it. Like, the mansions and the jets and everything, like, isn't it the Hollywood? So he just sold most of his stuff and just became like a almost full-time philanthropist, and that was a big impact for me early on.
How did you meet him?
He was a teacher. He was teaching at my college.
Oh, okay.
And so my senior year, I ended up getting like sitting in on his class. I wasn't even enrolled. And was just sitting on because he was giving out pizza, and I was like, oh, I want some free pizza. And then just completely had my mind warped of like, oh, like, this is like this is how big it is and how important it is to like make an impact, and there's so many ways you could do that. And so got really close with him, was like working with him on like his, he had a book that was, he was coming out, so it helped kind of organize like some of the online social media campaign for that, and the and some college tour stuff for that. And then just stayed connected with him. So like I would help him out on like whenever, you know, he ended up going out to Memphis and working with kids in Memphis. And so just stay connected to that. And then just like local, like I said, like volunteering projects whenever things came up. I feel like been fortunate to always stay involved in that somehow.
Yeah.
And just connecting people a lot of the times too, like organizations that might need something, try and give them the right connection, whether it's a brand or an individual or whatever. Just however I can serve. I found out for me, early on, what I learned was like, figure out your role, how you can optimize like your ability to serve. And so like my older sister went after college, she went into the Peace Corps, and she was in Peru. She was in Peru for several years, and she was working on the ground doing a lot of good. I ended up getting to visit her one time, doing amazing things, and the Peace Corps does amazing things. And for me, I realized that I could go do that, or I can figure out a way to, if I could figure out a way to fund 10 people to go to the Peace Corps, or like, you know, multiple impact, like just because my skill set like is such that I am used to like speaking to masses in some way, communicating with the masses in some way.
Yeah.
So for me, that became like, oh, a better avenue to serve. In addition to like serving hands on here, like whether it's at Watts Empowerment Center, Urban Saddles or whatever.
Yeah.
Allocating more of like my focus on that side has yielded a lot of positive results for a lot of organizations, a lot of people. So and I think a lot of times I had people early on tell me like, hey, like use the skills that you're given or use the whatever, find your role. And so that's what I've always wanted to do. And I'm half black, half Mexican. But in America, I pretty much identify as black because that's how the world identifies me.
Right.
I embrace both cultures and I'm very proud and stoked in both cultures, but I know that's how the world typically sees me. So especially like non-black people.
Yeah.
So it has, and that's always been, understanding that has always been that like identity and what it means in America, like as far as, you know, having that talk with my dad when I was like a little kid about like, hey, like here's how you have to interact like with the police and here's how you interact with like security or whatever, because they're going to treat you differently. Like stuff like that was at the same time though, like I wasn't raised at all in like a victim mentality. Like I think people tend to think that like acknowledging something makes it like a victimhood thing.
Right.
And it was never that. It was never like, I was
like,
always
okay.
told like, hey, but like they didn't teach it. And most people in our community, like in the black community especially, like don't teach it as like a victim thing. And that's like a narrative that gets pushed a lot, is people are like, oh, well, you know, you guys are just spreading a victim mentality by talking about racism. It's like, no, that's not how anything works. Like that's not how anything works, but especially this. And so it's just, we're just talking about it because you should be aware of it.
Yeah.
Like you should be aware of the realities of where you live and how it may impact you. And it's not like,
right.
And it was never a barrier. And that was, you know, also like, I'm never a barrier in my head. Like there were actual barriers.
There were
in terms
things
of
actually happening in your
things
life.
Things actually happening.
But
like,
mentally, you were above that.
Yeah, like being stopped by a police helicopter when I was like 13, 14 years old with like 20 police officers around me, guns drawn, because something happened some way and the only description they had was like a black male.
Right.
And it turned out they were looking for like an adult and they're like, oh, this is not who we were looking for, and like just peaced out. And that was, you know, fairly significant traumatic experience, but like, you know how, fortunately, like, because I was prepped, like I knew how to respond in that situation,
right.
Like compliance and not running and all those things, but like super lucky because
maybe
a year earlier, maybe a different day, I would have just panicked because I'm a child and I would have ran or something. And then I could have ended up on the news for not surviving that incident. And then everybody'd be like, well, why did he run, without acknowledging that like kids panic? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Why don't somebody not shoot? You know, and it's just like they're,
and it's so, even more so because the media is portrayed just like black people getting shot. So even being a white person, you don't even if you're in the same exact situation,
you wouldn't be scared.
You wouldn't be as scared because you're not seeing white dudes getting shot for not doing anything.
Yeah.
So if you're not doing anything, you don't think about it. At least for me, like growing up, I never, ever thought about it. And I grew up in just a very white community too.
Yeah.
So even the ideas of like that you had to get a talk about that subject, it's not that I probably didn't understand maybe something about that in our culture, but like now an adult and 2020 happening and everything going down, it's just like, it was as if I was just like, why did I not know more about this? Because it's not that I don't want to know, but I think largely it's just part of the communities that we're in and our just overall culture, just like,
No, it's both. It's both. It's the communities that we're in, and then also there's a very intentional drive to not talk about it. Like across the board, both socially in terms of, you know, it's not something that we talk about in polite company, and then also in terms of systemically, like like the organizations in charge, like we'll figure out, hey, what else can we talk about instead of this, instead of the root cause. And so that is, that was a big turning point for me, was what you just said on that reality. Because basically me and two of my roommates, one of them Mexican, one of them white, from an area that he grew up, same thing, like not around super diversity at all. And we got pulled over, and the cops, like my freshman year at Pepperdine, I went to Pepperdine in Malibu, very ritzy area. You know, I got pulled over 11 times in my first 9 months for like some sort of checkup, like, oh, hey, like, just want to see how, like, if you need anything or if you're okay or whatever, like, just some, always some sort of reason that wasn't a real reason. But
yeah,
at the time I didn't realize like that's super illegal.
Yeah.
But, just was like, oh, like, you know, this is just, I just came to expect it. And so, and always, you know, polite. That's what I think people is the thing people forget is that like, it's not. There's not this group of like evil right. For the most part. Like, I think for the most part, most of these situations isn't like some sort of malicious form
right.
of racism.
On an individual level. Right.
It is something that is systemic. That's just like, yeah. Hey, like if you stop, there's just this video, these officers stopped this guy. He was walking in Hollywood with like, I think Versace bag. And he ended up being like, they stopped him, basically a stop and frisk. Like they stopped him for jaywalking. In Hollywood,
yeah.
In Beverly Hills.
Right.
And he had a Versace bag, and they're like, hey, like, and then they search him, they frisk his whole body, and then they're just talking to him, and they're just like, and they're super polite, and he's just like, hey, like, this is not cool. And he's like, Instagramming himself, like, the video, just like, this is kind of messed up. And on top of this, he's actually a VP for Versace.
Nice.
So he's like, this is all stupid. And the department was just talking about, oh, well, you know, we just, that's like, for jaywalking, that's why we pull over. It's just like, but then you have all of these white people who are like, I jaywalk in Beverly Hills all the yeah. time. I've never been stopped. And if I have been stopped, I certainly wasn't searched.
Definitely.
And just like, it is that people, we have trouble holding that duality of like, it's not that they're bad people. And it's not even that they're doing it consciously. No, for the most part, I don't think they're looking back. Here's a black guy, let me search him. They're
yeah.
just like, I'm going to search this person because like, I want to see if they have a warrant out or whatever. And it's
right.
just like, oh, it's almost innocent, which makes it that much more insidious. That's
yes.
the most insidious part of it, is it's yeah. usually well-intentioned or whatnot, and just not acknowledging the systems that are in place and the things that have been done. So it, but what you were saying earlier about not being aware of it. So it was me and two of my roommates, and we got pulled over, and the officer was just like, hey, I was just checking. He's like, oh, yeah, we're just Pepperdine students. So he looked at our IDs. He's like, oh, do you guys have any drugs or anything? And and we're like, no. Like, and he asked us that twice, and we're like, no, still no. Like,
yeah.
like
that's
the first time. He's like, okay. And then, sorry, that's when he asked us he's like, oh, where are you guys? Where? Oh, we're at Pepperdine. We showed him our student IDs. He's like, oh, yeah, okay, on your way. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
So we peaced out, and we were in our room, and my roommate, the white when he said, he's like, you know, I don't think I could believe that happened if I wasn't there. And it's not because, like, I don't believe you guys, because none
right.
of you guys are trustworthy. Just because in his head, it was so unimaginable
yeah.
to happen. Like
yeah.
it just is like, well, obviously, officers only pull over people when they have a reason.
Yes.
Like, they only interact with people. So it's just like, that would never, like, it was
yeah.
telling him the sky was, you know, green. And it's just
yeah.
like, oh, that for me was the biggest switch that I had in my head. That's like,
yeah.
okay. We have to change this conversation because we're talking from different realities.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a pivotal moment for me, and being in that environment, that's the other thing. Like, I've been in that environment of being like, Pepperdine's a very white space. My high school was a very white space. Like, and I was only there, because like where I grew up in Victorville was a city. The school that was around the corner from me, the high school, was all black and Mexican. It was one of the first high schools to get its own sheriff's unit. Like, not a great
yeah.
Academic spot for a variety of reasons. They had abysmal like college ratings and everything. So it was, my mom didn't want us to go there. So she put us in like essentially a lottery, which I'm literally a lottery
yeah.
for inter-district transfer. So we can go to the nicer school. As it tends to be the case generally, is the whiter school. And so that was a school that had like 87, I think, black kids out of like 3,000 students, 87 black males. I don't remember how many females, but out of like over 3,000 students. And so the school buses don't get you, so we had to take the city bus an hour each way to get there. And so essentially I was bused like to school,
yeah.
You know, bakes up in the 2000s. And
just by yourself.
I know, my older sister was there okay. 1 year with me concurrently.
Yeah.
And then I was only there a couple of years just because for a variety of reasons, I ended up switching schools to a different, there's this charter school that opened up that let me do like college classes. But just having even those 2 years, that opportunity, like I could see how much that put me ahead. Like just the type of environment that it was. change so much. And that had nothing to do, like that had to do, you know, my mom got us into the program, but there's a, his name's Anand. I can't remember his last name, but he's a, he has a TED talk, and he was in, he's in a lot of interviews and such talking about like income inequality and wealth gaps and racial gaps and all these things. And he says, he has a line in his TED talk that's about two Americas. And he says how it's very important to not make the mistake that many Americans make when they achieve some level of success. That is, you should never forget that you're the exception and not the rule. And like that is very easy to forget here because we preach individualism.
Yes.
So strongly, and it's so important. Like it is. That's the duality of everything. It is important to like you. If you have cancer, they've done studies to show like pot. Like if you think you're gonna get through it, your odds actually increase. Like you're thinking, your mindset, all these things matter.
Right,
and they do matter.
Mm-hmm.
But so does everything else. So does like this. So everything matters together. So we have to talk about both. We can't just talk about one.
Yeah, because then you see like the one black guy who came out and he's just preaching like it's just you are doing
we it literally just had that the RNC
and it's not that or the other thing. It's like what you're saying is truthful. You're literally standing there and you did what you said you did,
yes,
but you're disregarding the other. It's not that and or that, it's both of them. And plus, like, why would you, if you had beaten the system, got out of it? One, I do think it's a little bit of a lack of understanding that there was some luck involved in that person's story.
Yep.
Because they feel that they willed themselves into it. And it's like, well, one thing could have went south and it you wouldn't have been able to have willed yourself into it. So I'm glad that you did. But somebody else might have worked harder than you and didn't.
Yeah.
And you're just telling them that they're wrong?
I mean, like I did most of us did nothing to be born here. Like in America,
nobody.
Time, this century, this millennia.
Think like, about that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we do not choose where we're born.
Yeah. And I think that's always, you know, to digress slightly, like on the citizenship thing, that's always been, like I hate entitlement around citizenship because it's just like most people didn't earn that. Like most of us didn't earn citizenship. And like even if we were able to get here, there's usually some sort of like exceptionalism that allowed people to get there. Like, and I say that as like my grandfather came into America in his 20s and got his citizenship, and it was challenging for sure. And, and it's amazing. And we're super thankful. And it's not to take, and that's the thing. It's like acknowledging truths doesn't take away anybody's achievements. And people tend to feel that way. They tend to feel like if I have to acknowledge that luck was involved in like anything in any element at all, then like that takes away from it. It doesn't like it doesn't mean nobody thinks that except for your ego. Your ego is the only thing that thinks that.
Yeah.
Like everything else is just like there's realities that I have a very positive leaning mindset and it's helped me significantly. I was born with that. Like or had it ingrained from like my parents being positive thinkers.
Yeah.
Like, but that was not any like I've harnessed, you know, I've increased it and have kept feeding into it, which is for sure like I'll have choices and stuff, but how did I get it? Like not on my own accord.
Right.
And that's, I just want, it's that luck element that you acknowledge. And so I think seeing now this conversation now happening more often for at least a time, like you said, I don't know if it was in the first recording or second recording, but it was like there was a hopeful element to that of like seeing everyone pause and talk about it. And then there is that disheartening vibe of like it not being a conversation anymore, but it's not like hopeless for a couple of reasons. Because one, we have, it was bigger than it's ever been. Like,
yeah.
I've talked to people who were alive in the 60s and like and were talking about and there have been speakers and like Republican Representative John Lewis, and rest in peace, a legend for the civil rights movement. Like he talked about there being a difference, like it was different than for sure. Everybody paid attention back then, but this was a world stage. This was deep. This was in daily conversations. It was unavoidable.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe the pandemic, in that way, was that positive way of like acknowledging that.
Yeah.
And
potentially, I think like it forced us all to just have to stare at it.
Yeah. And after hearing,
we couldn't just go to work and forget about it and pretend like it's not happening. Like everybody was just sitting around. So it was like,
Yeah.
What are you going to do with it now?
The question about it too was acknowledging that fortunately the big conversation that I think was most prevalent was that concept of like being anti-racist. You can't just not be racist. Like that is not being racist is being a part of being racist. As opposed to being anti-racist, because not being racist is to allow the status quo to occur, and we know that the status quo is racist. So and that doesn't mean it doesn't mean that everyone in it, like I said, is malicious or anything like that. It just is coming to terms like, oh, okay, there are all of these very real things that we need to talk about. And of course, like individually, like we can all talk about things and like culturally and all these things, but it's all of those conversations have to happen. And like, what can we do about it? And that is when I think about the conversation like dying down, the positive thing is that there's a good amount of voices that are like, hey, like as we look to returning to normal, like let's question what normal looks like. Like let's make sure that like, okay, we might fix this but not this, or like how can we restructure, reshape things, because it's built into everything the same way like sexism, patriarchy is built into every aspect of our society. Like it's everywhere. So now it's like, okay, how do we look at all of these things? If we pay attention now and we don't return to like normal, that is going to be the deciding factor. And fortunately, I think that what we did see is more involvement, and going back to, you know, the responsibility side, like more involvement in the decision making, like remembering like, oh, this is a democracy that we say it's for the people and by the people. But by the people, what we've been forgetting is like that means that we have to participate. Mm-hmm. And we have to participate more than once every 4 years or more than once every 2 years. Like there's like in Los Angeles, we had a meeting on like the city budget that literally the night before, I saw tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people mobilized on social media, posting like, hey, we need to make sure that we call in and email and to say like, hey, this, we want to change in our budget for the city of Los Angeles. Yep. And it's like, it was beautiful to see. And that's activation. That's great. But there were meetings before that one that none of us talked about. And there was which I think it's not just me. I think a lot of us are like, oh, we need to actually participate all the time. And the positive side is that we have the numbers. So that's right now is kind of like the work that I'm trying to do, like with, you know, whether it's a movement for Black Lives in LA or like Urban Saddles or any other organization that I'm in touch with.
Yeah.
It's trying to figure out like, okay, how do we mobilize? Because we have the numbers people-wise. It's not like the money can for sure impact elections in a huge way, and it does. And so, you know, right here in LA, like LA County, we have the district attorney race. The sitting district attorney is a woman named Jackie Lacey, who's just the worst for all as far as her policies and things that she's done and hasn't done, has just been criminalizing children, no repercussions for like cops. Like even literally the chief of police was like, hey, this cop should be prosecuted, and she didn't because the unions told her not to, and the unions give her all of her money. They gave her $6 million this year for this election, and so, and it's a runoff right now because she didn't get enough support at the earlier election. So this is the runoff. So it's George Gascon is her opponent, pretty much the antithesis of everything. Like he doesn't accept money from police unions. He's actually been fighting to get their money out of all of politics because he's like, that's not fair for you to take money from the people that you are supposed to prosecute.
Right.
And we've seen it. She then doesn't prosecute them.
Right.
He's like, we shouldn't probably criminalize children. We should, you know, give them restorative justice, which is a big thing that people, progressive people have been pushing. Is like, hey, if we have this 14-year-old that commits a crime, rather than throwing them in jail and making them a tax burden on our city of like $116,000, I think it's average like $116,000 a year.
Yeah.
That's the tax burden for putting them in the system. We could actually give them restorative justice, some sort of like training program where they get to work off, like if they stole something, they can return it, or they can work off that debt. They can learn and do leadership programs and all these things. And then all of a sudden now those kids stay out of jail. They don't have a record. They get a job. Now they're tax contributions to the society, positive in every way, rather than a negative aspect of society. Yeah. So like it just makes sense, but it's not as easy. it's easy in our head just to punish because it's quicker. So there's so many little things like that. And so when we look at those races, like those that race, the police unions like don't have more people than the citizens. Like we've seen the marches, we've seen we know the quantity of people's there.
Right.
It's the action. So like somebody from police unions is meeting with the district attorney in their office every week, like in talking to them or on phone calls and emails. So like if we expand our numbers now and we talk to people and we're like, hey, and it doesn't have to be this, whatever the issue is that you care about, find out like, can I be involved? And because your involvement is not as strenuous as it sounds. Like literally we have enough, if we had half of the people, a tenth of the people who like shared that post that last night, if they were to be like, hey, like how do we help year round? We could have all those people on a rotating schedule and all you have to do is make one phone call a year. And we can make sure that if you play that math out, that office would get 100 phone calls a day.
Yeah.
Like, because it's 100 times 365 and that's 36,000 people. We had hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah. So it's like if we grab 36,000 that commit to making one phone call one time a year, that office would get 100 calls a day. And then so they would have to hear this voice and they'd have to be influenced by it the same way they're influenced by these other voices. So like that has been my work now, has been when I'm looking at, because I went to the marches and like spoke at some of the marches, you know, had some different organizations ask me to speak and like loved it and empowering for those communities and for those people. But then it was like, well, what are we doing? Like, what are we going to do with this energy? And like, to be clear, like marches are important.
Yeah.
Like the demonstrations, letting people know, like, I think I saw, you know, whether it was even like the women's group campaign, the march for women that happened after Trump was elected, like people were talking about like, you know, how it's like, well, what's the point of like just complaining? It's like, oh, it's just letting people know like, hey, we actually don't agree with this rhetoric. We don't agree with this policy and we want to make that clear. And so, and it makes it impossible to like, you know, it was the march in Selma and those images that brought the civil rights movement to the White House in the way that it needed to be brought to make that step at that time. So like demonstrations matter. And having, so all of it matters.
Right.
But then we also have to do, we also have to get the policy in place. We have to get the money in place, the funding. So like whatever we can do is kind of that next step. And so my hopes are to in this part of the monologue is that we can now get more, everyone, is that everyone, even though we're not talking about it, at the very least, when we give them an action step, they can take that action step.
Yeah.
That's my like optimistic viewpoint of like, it's died down, but that's hopefully what we have left over.
I would think so. I mean, I think, it's definitely died down. It's not the cool thing to talk about anymore.
Yeah.
Culture's like, whatever. But I do think it was impactful enough that, yes, when, hey, vote on something or we see something, people won't be so easy to just turn a blind eye.
Yes.
Because it's like, and speaking just as like a white male, it was just, I didn't know exactly, which is such a horrible excuse to have. But that's honestly, I'm not going to lie and pretend like I knew something when I didn't know. And now that I know and going through this process, like I've learned a lot and I'm going to continue to learn a lot. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who maybe I'm not hearing them publicly talk about it, but they're probably still learning a lot. They're probably digging into things. They're talking with their close friends still. They're still going through a process of learning a lot. And so, yeah, when it comes to the boring things like making a phone call, getting on a team where you're one of the people, I think that is probably happening. But I also think like we need people who are organizing that.
Yeah, and there are. It's just taking time. But like what's something that I think that is super brave and honest for you to acknowledge like, hey, like, yeah, that it's a horrible excuse to have not known, but I didn't. And if people are willing to acknowledge stuff they didn't know and like acknowledge, like, you know, acknowledge anything really, acknowledge any levels of ignorance is huge. Like, is there anything that stands out to you that like, when you say you didn't know, it's like, oh, I didn't know this. And this was life, like this was pivotal for my perspective or understanding.
Yeah. I mean, so much of it, dude, I did not realize how much of the system was working so against Black people and anybody of color, like how it, but then going through it, it's kind of obvious. That's what's so crazy.
Yeah.
And friggin' that you guys all knew And that's just normal life for you. That was the most mind-blowing. It's the same situation. Your buddy's in the car with you, and he's just like, what just happened? If I was not in the car with you, that would have been hard to believe.
Yeah.
That. And then you're just seeing it on the news or something, which is like fully, like, whatever. That's so far removed at that point that it's like, well, what was the real story? It was easy to paint that picture just as growing up in my experience, especially because I've never ever had fear of the police or something like that. The police in my experience throughout my entire life has always been what they're painted as like, just to serve and protect. And like when there's police around, it felt safer.
Yeah.
And never when I got pulled over, am I ever thinking that like I need to, of course, be respectful. Like, I want to try to get out of a ticket. I don't want to get like make it worse. I'm not going to like be a jerk and belligerent to a police officer. But then now learning more about it, like getting pulled over for no reason, it'd be really hard not to be a little bit of a jerk to someone who's kind of being a jerk to me. Like, there's a difference of I got pulled over probably because the taillight's out, probably because I was speeding. Probably for a actual reason. And then they're not asking me if I have drugs or some, like that's happened a few times. If I'm with friends and we look like snowboard, like, or skater punks. And they're like, so I've only very little where it's just like, just getting hounded. Like, do you have weed? And they would ask like 10 times. And it's like, no, what are you even getting at? Because we're wearing beanies. Like, what?
So that's a great example, because it's like, because we're wearing beanies, but it's just like, because I'm wearing
my your skin?
Yeah, and so I say
and
all this.
So it's like, that's what I mean. It's like this tiny bit, but what you just said, because I was choosing to look a certain way, where it's like, now I'm seeing like, oh, that happens all the time to this whole group of people, literally because of the color of your skin. There's absolutely nothing you can do about that. Like, it was just crazy to see and start like, and talking with people for the first time, like having really open conversations like with you and some other people. And it was cool being in LA while this was going down,
because
if I was at home, I really wouldn't have had many people to like talk to. And plus then a lot of them are kind of just like, well, you're kind of doing it to yourself, because they also grew up where they're not being profiled.
Yeah.
Like, they're black in a community of white people not getting pulled over because the police are just not pulling them over. It's like, oh, hey, it's so-and-so's kid. Like, that's how small of a town we're from. Like, they're not assuming that they're doing something. They actually know who it is. It's the, like, one of five black people in the community. So, like, they also didn't experience what that was. So being in LA where I was, like, able to have conversations with people who weren't white and being able to have like these open and honest conversations of like just wanting to learn and like hear and understand like what I could have been doing better or what I can be doing better and all of that. But I also remember just thinking like right in the heat of it, of being like, oh, I've always wondered like, would I have like marched with Martin Luther King back then?
Yeah.
And it's like, if people are really being honest with themselves, and if you just look at the actual numbers, you most statistically, as a white male, you would not have.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you wouldn't have maybe supported and wanted the best for him in their movement, but you kind of would have just stayed at home.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't have been walking into work and being like, man, this guy, I'm just so pumped. I hope that he just gets everything that he wants. Like, you just probably not talk about it.
His daughter talked about I think it's Time Magazine or somebody did a poll maybe a year or two before he died, while he was still alive, and asked about like if you think that, you know, is like positive sentiments or negative sentiments, and most of the country was negative sentiments towards Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
So like most of the country
hated him.
Hated him or disliked him. They one of the most common like pieces of rhetoric at the time was, and this is, you know, in the 50s, like prior to Civil Rights Act being signed, or like maybe early 60s or something, they would, a common rhetoric was that black people already have it so good. yeah. too good, like, is what some people said. Like, they're like, well, they already have everything on a silver platter. Do they need, what more do they need?
Yeah.
Was the right, and it's just like, and it's not
the same
evil.
Conversation that we're having again.
Yes.
That was also what was mind blowing. I kept looking back and like watching old videos of like Martin Luther King and looking at old news articles to see what the media talked about. And it was, I was just like, well, now I know, because we're literally having the same conversation again.
A lot of them.
But the difference, at least not being super educated in it, it did feel like there was just way more white people this time that were like, whoa, whoa, like myself, that were just like, what?
Yeah.
Like, no, like it, they don't have it super great. Like, what are you even talking about? Even though there were still people like, they literally have everything that you have. And then there's even the over where they're like, they get more scholarships than you. Yeah. They have actually more opportunity than you have.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, just like, just chill for a second and stop and just listen to somebody who's asking you to listen to them. That's what it felt like. And like, but yeah, it also just felt like an opportunity to act on what would I have done if this was like in the civil rights movement. It felt like a second wave of that, where it was like more opportunity to just like walk into that. And it just, it almost felt like it just kind of like went dormant. And like you were saying earlier, how it's like, there's just these things that keep just trying to bury it and not allow it.
And that's so exactly it.
Then it kind of just got like dug up. But I think a lot more people, especially I think our generation, like
it is
millennials
more.
Are just way more down to be like, well, what?
Yeah.
Like, huh?
Well, it's like, and also it's the connection. So like now kids are growing up online. They're connecting with different people, mm-hmm. more diverse people. So like whether it's genders or sexual orientations or race, they, there's a, I think it's Brene Brown has like a quote that says, you know, hate has trouble standing up to contact. And so it's like when you're in contact with these people, you're like, because it's always easy to care about people that you know. It's a little bit easier. And so now it's like, oh, now everybody knows each other so much. So that's been a big part of it. And the other side of it too, that I just like to acknowledge only because I think it's important that people acknowledge it for conversation's sake, is like, there's so much progress. Like, it's not like nothing's changed since the 60s.
Yeah.
It's not like nothing's changed since slavery. It's not like everything's worse and it's the worst time to be a black person ever in the history of America. It's not. It is arguably in so many ways the best time. But it's just like when, if you're in a relationship and they used to beat you every day, closed fist, and now they only beat you every once in a while, open hand, it's like, this is better.
Yeah.
But not what we'd like.
Yes.
And like, let's keep trying to get better. And I think that people tend to get defensive in terms of like they are so caught up in like, can't you acknowledge how much better we've been? And like, you know, how like that they care about that acknowledgement. Like a big saying is like, you know, people are much more afraid of like being called a racist than doing something racist. So it's like very similar. The country it has this overall rhetoric of like, well, we can't we just acknowledge how much better it's gotten? It's like, yeah, of course it's gotten better, but like we can't stop now. Like we need to, like if we stand for liberty and justice for all, like Dr. Cornel West, one of my favorite lines is how justice is what love looks like in public.
Yeah.
And it's just like, this is what we're looking at. We're like, how do we create this you know, more equitable, more increase equality, equal access to so many things?
Yeah.
And it's not like, and there's just so many ways that we can do that.
Right.
And so we want to find out how to do that. And we want people to feel. And then that's why I like to acknowledge. I like to acknowledge like, hey, of course there's been progress. Like, all right, great. Now we agree on that. Now let's talk about where we're still coming short. It's like, of course, most police officers are trying to do something good. Like they're like.
Right.
The rhetoric of, oh, you know, that's taken over a conversation. Like I have law enforcement that's in my direct family and in my extended family. And like people like literally, you know, have been on ride alongs like family and everything. So I have a very the duality exists in my own personal experience of like positive and negative interactions. And I understand like it's so, you know, we're so thankful for law enforcement. It's not like nobody. But the conversation isn't so much like all, you know, people, a popular phrase like all ACAB, like all cops are bad.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's not that they're, people are saying that they're all evil people. They're saying that this, they're all part of a system that has problems.
Right.
And so the system is problematic. Granted, I'm not saying that they should all just quit because we have too many people. We, like, society needs to shift in some way. But that's the conversation, is like, let's have a conversation about this. Let's acknowledge, like, hey, there's problems here that we need to fix.
Yeah.
And there's something that we need to do. And so whether you look at, you know, whether it's defund the police or like abolish the police or whatever, I think that people are so quick to get defensive about some things that nobody wants to have a tougher conversation that's like, hey, like maybe we should rethink how we do things. Like I always, I always tell people, I'm like, you'd be surprised, but everyone that you know is in favor of defunding the police and abolishing the police. And like, I like to say, like, you know, say it controversial like that, because it's like, oh, no, no. Like, are you, wouldn't you be for getting rid of cancer hospitals? Like, if it meant getting rid of cancer? Like, if we, if we're talking about getting rid of the disease, the need for these things, then that's, and that's what the conversation is actually about.
Right.
It's not just saying wave one.
That's really complicated what you just said.
Did that?
No, I get it.
Yeah.
But I understand how some people would not understand what you just said.
Well, and so it's, it is, if we're looking at, you know, cancer hospitals, and I'm like, hey, defund cancer hospitals, get rid of all cancer doctors. Like, really quickly, our brain's like, wait, what are we going to do about all the people with cancer then?
Exactly.
The conversation that we're actually trying to have is like, no, let's figure out how to get rid of cancer. And then we do that. Then we get rid of them.
Exactly.
That's going to be less cancer. And so it's very similar in the sense of how,
like,
do we get rid of...
Let's allocate a ton of this...
this resource.
Resources that's just getting dumped into a really terrible system that's just kind of barely limping people through cancer.
Yes. And everybody right now says, like, hey, like, oh, well, because officers are, in so many ways, they're underfunded in tons of ways.
Yes.
Like, in terms of not having enough officers to do all these calls and all these things. But it's just like, we, instead of looking at adding more funding, let's look at adding less calls. Like, how do we decrease the amount of calls that they have coming in? And it's not like decreasing as in, like, we have all of the social workers take over everything. We have, it's like, no, let's decrease the load for everyone. Like, let's figure out how do we take care of people, not like in a, not just take care of people like in some magical way, but like in practical, responsible, efficient ways. How do we create a better side? Like, maybe that's restorative justice, where we're not putting as many people in jail. That way they can be contributors to society instead of detractants in some way. And all these other things that we can hit. How do we do these things? And so we have to, the problem is, we, at least in my opinion, is that we lack that bridge of like realizing that we actually want the same thing. We're like, hey, don't we want less crime? Like, okay, cool.
Right.
So let's talk about that. How do, what is causing crime? And like, what's causing this? And what's causing these problems? And what are all, and what can we do on different fronts? Like, that is the honest conversation that like can actually move us forward.
Right.
And it's okay to acknowledge, like, yeah, for sure, this is better. For sure, these people are good. But like, the line between good and evil is, you know, often in the heart of every single person. It's not like all the bad people are in one place. It's like there's good and bad kind of in all of us. And then sometimes it's not even bad. You know, it's just like, hey, I'm just enforcing. They just had that in Kentucky. Well, I don't, with Breonna Taylor case, there's so many layers to that that we can definitely get into, because it's very near and dear to my heart and in so many hearts, because it says so many things about our society and everything and a lot of the issues. But one of the things that stood out to me is the actual attorney general said, like, we don't have the tools in our laws to be able to prosecute this the way maybe it should be. Like, he said, like, he essentially said, like, this is a tragedy. Our system isn't designed to handle it, which is saying, like, acknowledging we don't have a way to give justice here because of our system that's in place. And it's just like, and you know, does that make him evil? No. Is he a horrible person for other reasons? Arguably, but that's a deeper conversation.
Right.
But at the very least, that conversation was very much to me a standout. Like, oh yeah, like, how do we improve our system so that we can get what everyone is actually looking for? A safer society, more equitable society, like, and because often we're looking for the same things.
Yeah.
We just have to be willing to have the tough conversations as to how to get there. And tough conversations for everybody. It's like, personal responsibility is a tough conversation. Systemic problems are a tough conversation. Like, it's just that we have the ability to control our systemic problems. We have a process for that.
Right.
So we should use the one that's easy for us to control.
Right. Man, how do you think, like, how do we bridge that gap? Because at one side, there are people... How do you get people to get away from the extremes?
So
that they'll have an actual conversation. Because I think you're right. I think 90%+ of Americans do kind of ultimately want something that looks very similar, but it's hard to get to the conversation that gets people on common ground.
Yes. I think we have to be able to, what you did, like acknowledge like our shortcomings, which is difficult because literally America's design, like our society is designed not to do that. It is designed to only, you know, it's a win-lose mentality only. It
right.
is, you know, if I'm wrong, then I'm dumb and I can't look dumb because I can't look weak. And it's just like, well, what if, like we just say, like, I don't know and I want to learn that and I want to hear that and letting people be heard. And unfortunately, one part of it too that we have to do is have, is there is what I always tell, especially white people that are asking like about how to participate. One of the things I tell them is like resilience, because you're going to talk to someone who has a very reasonable case for not wanting, for not having any patience for white people. Like there's a lot of reasons why they may feel like and so much of it is like, you know, you come to the table and they're like, where the F have you been all this time? Like, I don't even want your help. Get out of here. You're awful. You're the problem. You're the enemy. And that's from so many years of like pain and anger and like, what is it? I think also Dr. Cornel West has a line. He just says like, you know, it is astonishing when you consider that there's not a black version of the KKK that's been built.
Like
the fact that an organization that specifically is after people, lynching people directly, like just for that reason, like it's
even how is there not one tiny group of 10, 20, 50 people? That doesn't make any sense.
It is astonishing. When I thought, I was like, wow, that is astonishing to think about. That there's not recognizable, like, or there's not like that name that is recognizable like that. Like if there's individual actors here and there, like maybe, but that's crazy to me. But it is, so you have people who have this very reasonable anger and frustration because it's all the small stuff that built up. It's not like one thing. It's a combination of things that build up over time and generational, and it's so recent. Like people, like I'm 29.
Yeah.
Me and my older sister, my older sister's 32. We always talk about this. Like we're the first generation of our family that was born with an unhindered right to vote.
Right.
Like the first generation of our family are millennials. And so it's so recent.
Yeah.
So it is, but as far as like, how do we have the conversation? I think it's just like being willing to, when you come up to that person, that's like, you know, screw you. Where have you been all this time? You know, screw all of you. You have to then be like, I get that. I understand. Like I've had that interaction with women, like literally, women, they're just like, all men are trash. I don't deal with men. And I don't have anything to say to you. And I'm like, I understand why you feel that way. Only to as much as I can. Like, it makes sense to me why you feel that way. I respect it. If there's anything I can do to help, let me know. And then I move on to somebody else who is there to help. Because there's also people, whether it's women or people in LGBTQ or people or black people, there are also plenty of people like, I wish you were here sooner, but I'm glad you're here now.
Yeah.
Let's get to work. Like, let's do something.
Yeah.
And so it is incumbent upon you, if you truly want to make a difference, to find those people, because it's really easy to meet that first person and to be like, well, I guess I shouldn't help anybody then. I guess I'm not going to help.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful excuse. Like when you come in and you say something and everyone wants to attack you, when you were trying to do something good, like it's really easy to hear just those voices and to ignore the fact that like, no, there's plenty of other voices that are out here. Like, Hey, come with us. Like, yes, we absolutely can use the help. Like, let's work together. Let's take, because we should all be on the same side.
Yeah.
We should all be on the same side.
That's what's so crazy about. It's like, we're all American.
Yeah.
And then as being like, if we're talking about this in like that sense of being American, and like for me, as like in the wake like of George Floyd's death and all the things that happened after that, I'm just like, wait, what? Like, we want, this is what America wants.
Yeah.
This is very American of us to do these things, to want people to be equal, to want justice, to want like to want to be the best. Like, well, it's, and not on an individual level, which I think that is what's hindering us, because individually we're trying to be the best. Individually we're trying to succeed. Individually we're trying to do all those things. And so maybe that is the little bit of like what America used to be good at, is being like rallying together to like be the best together.
Yes.
And it's like, that's what I am feeling we're lacking in. And it's like, and like we were saying earlier, most of us want the same thing, even if it's a little bit different, like the circle graphs that kind of overlap.
Yeah, yeah.
Venn diagrams. Like we're not, we're not exactly going to line up. If you really think about it, you don't line up with any other human being who's ever existed, ever. Like no two people have ever perfectly aligned on what they believe. If they do, they're probably part of a cult. And they don't actually, if they really get down to what they really believe. And that's where it's like, get rid of this individual only mindset and realize that the, like, we can be much better if we come on common ground with one another and have these conversations.
The common ground, I think, is so important, because it's the thing that we're missing is how we define the problem. Because I think like you mentioned George Floyd, and what was overlooked by most people is that is the outcome. That's a result.
Right.
Like, and people are like, oh, well, perfect. George Floyd happened. Let's just get rid of Derek Chauvin and the cops that were there. And they're like, cool. We did it. We solved it. And it's just like, well, that's not the issue. The issue isn't even, and in general, when people talk about, like, you know, black people being killed, it's like, that's a result too. Or black people being incarcerated. Like, that's all, those are all results. So it's like, we need to look at, you know, root causes, like how are, you know, whether it's gerrymandering or people being, you know, labeled at a young age by society in these different ways, and how we give that power. And then in school, like, you know, black kids are literally, you know, sent to the principal. They get detention, they get suspended more often, and even for the same offenses in school. So like, we know this happens in courts, but now we know it happens in schools. So it's not like, it's not even a cultural, like, you know, somebody's like, oh, well, what are they learning at home? It's like, no, like, literally we have kids that have the same issue that at the same school in the same, with the same teachers, and they get different punishments. And so it's like, it happens at every level, and we need to figure out, like, okay, how do, but that's not going to make sensational news. Like, if a kid that gets sent to the principal and unfairly, like, isn't going to make news. And then so then we allow all these other things to happen, and then we only talk about it when they get shot and or strangled or whatever. And so I think that that's kind of step one, is like getting people to define the problem. And I think why it's been challenging is because the problem is like kind of all of society.
Right.
Like all of us. And so it's just like, what if we've allowed, that's the downside to democracy, is that we're all responsible. And people are very adverse to acknowledging responsibility.
Yeah.
Everyone is.
Super hesitant to say, very, like, I was part of that problem.
Yes.
Especially because it's a problem that nobody, most people don't want.
Yeah.
Like, they don't want that. So it's much easier to just be like, wait a minute, maybe you're making it sound worse than it actually is.
Yeah.
Because if we acknowledge that it's as bad as it is, then what you just said, that means I'm part of the problem.
Then I have to do work. I don't want to do work. I have enough of my own problems.
Well, almost not even to that extent, where it's like that they don't want to do the work to, I mean, maybe subconsciously that is what's happening. But it's also just like this idea of like, I mean, even the being like not being racist, like having to be anti-racist, like even that, I think hits, not I think my generation, but people older than us, like it hits as if you're calling them a racist.
Yeah.
And they came from a generation where a lot of their family was racist. So their grandparents, they actually saw, and even they kind of knew, like, well, that's not cool what grandpa's doing or saying or treating people.
And that's not me.
And that's not me.
Yeah.
And so now they're feeling like people are basically calling them their grandpa. And it's like, they're just like, nope, like absolutely not.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not that. And it's like, and so defenses come up in this,
of course,
in a lot of the language that has come around all of this, which is just like back to the question of like, how do we get into the conversation to build the common ground? Because even that person wants to be anti-racist. The fact that they're so offended that they feel that you're calling them racist shows you that like,
definitely.
Okay, they, in their heart, they want to be what we're deeming as anti-racist. So it's like, but how do we come about it so that it doesn't feel like we're attacking them?
That's it. We have to remove, we have to remove the shame. Because that was the, if you, that talk, the bridge with Pastor John, like part of Oprah's Super Soul sessions.
Yeah.
I think his name was John Gray.
Yeah.
Actually.
Something Gray.
Yeah. And amazing, amazing talk, but he talks about like the shame aspect. Like, you, it's hard to shame people into things in any sort of long lasting way where people feel good. And so a lot of it, I think, just has to do with our overall conversations of like you said, like somebody's like, oh, like I'm, it's and semantics like matter, even though they shouldn't matter so much.
Right.
So like I always get on people and they're like, oh, like you're a racist. And it's like, you know, I don't say, I try and say language that's like, you're doing something racist or participating in something racist, because I know that like if you just call someone racist, like they're not going to feel good because they think racist means bad.
Right.
And it's like racism is bad and none of us want to do. It's like when somebody's, if I step on somebody's toe and I'm like, hey, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. And they're like, oh yeah, like, you know, no problem, whatever. It's like, it doesn't do any good if I'm like, hey, I didn't mean to step on your toe, so I don't need to apologize because it was an accident. It's just like, that doesn't help anyone. Instead of just, you know, acknowledging like, hey, like, oh shoot, I didn't mean to step on your toe, I'm sorry, like what, like let's make it better. And so I think it's just now for everyone to not shame, and to, like I said, recognize like, hey, I know that you're not that you're a good person, like doing something racist doesn't make you a bad person. Doing it intentionally or refusing to do anything, refusing to take action, is where all of a sudden you can come into character. But like, if you, like, most people are trying to do something good, and most people don't want, you know, don't want to be part of the problem, like you said. So sadly, unfortunately, I think it's that the first step is really that acknowledgement and that language shift. That's like, okay, how do we make sure that, like, I'm not shaming you, and I'm not, which it sucks that we have to coddle people into equality, but like,
yeah,
but it's the reality. And it's the same way anybody would want to be approached. It's anybody would want to be approached kindly and as if like they have good intentions. And there's a lot of people that are done doing that, and I get it, and I support 100%. That movement. But for me personally, that's where I've found myself, is like, okay, how do we have this conversation where I can acknowledge you and make sure people feel heard and understand like that I get the progress and positive things, and like, you know, not villainizing them, not villainizing police, not villainizing anything, because it's like none of it is usually that, none of it's like evil usually. It's just very much like, oh, okay. So I think that's the first step, is like removing the shame in conversations, so that way people can acknowledge like their own complicity as like, in it, without being afraid, like, and that's the fortunate part, is having conversations like this and other conversations. I had a deep conversation with like a Trump supporter where like I was like, hey, like obviously like we can see eye to eye on like all these things and talk about it, and so through that conversation I had people reach out to me afterwards, like like that were just like, hey, like I, you know, it was great when they knew they weren't going to be attacked, they could talk to me, and they were like,
exactly.
Hey, they could ask this question and ask that question, and then, you know, be like, oh, that makes sense, and change their mind, change their votes, or at least understand it better, which is my mission, is like, be honest, you know, acknowledge what's happening.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's like such a key point of like, I get why some people would listen to this and just be like, whatever, like, get over yourself. Like, you want to just like, oh, let's just be nice and not be too abrupt. But it's, unfortunately, it's not going to be effective if you attack. And so, which is such a catch 22, because I see the wanting justice and wanting, which is like what has happened forever. And it's like, on the flip side, like, white people have gotten that so many times in history, where and it's
usually via violence.
Yeah,
too.
That's what I mean. Like, literal, like, vengeance, violence, like, and it's praised upon. It's like,
of course,
glory.
James Baldwin.
Awesome. It's like, freaking, we're the best. So we just like came in and just like
manifest
did our thing. And now that it's kind of like flipped, neither side wants to, like...
Yeah, nobody like, wants to go that way.
Like, white people don't want to be like, oh, I'm like a fragile little white person that needs you to, like, be nice on how you we communicate this, because we understand the flip side of, like, how we've dealt with, historically, white people have dealt with things. And it's like, but that's just not...
I mean,
it's just not going to be effective.
On that specific comment, like, James Baldwin, iconic writer, civil rights movement person, activist, he had a line. He was on TV on, like, one of the big talk shows, and he said, you know, anywhere in the world, if a white person says, give me liberty or give me death, and they pick up a rifle, they are applauded. Except unless you're not white.
Right.
And you say the same thing in the same situation, and you're villainized instead of heroized.
Right.
And so you have, and I think that's good. I think that's growth for all of us. Like, I don't think violence is ideal for anybody.
Right.
But it's just acknowledging, like, hey, we started a war over taxes. Like, like, to start this country, like we started killing people over taxes. Like, I think over, you know, being treated like a human isn't, equality is, like, you know, a little bit more justified. And so,
totally.
Like I said, it's not, we shouldn't be doing that way. But I think that for people not to understand the passion, the anger there,
exactly.
Is like,
that's, I guess, the point that I'm trying long way around is that it makes so much sense to me. Like, the fact that when everything started going down, that people were confused was super confusing to me.
Yes.
Even though for me, I was like, oh, what? But instantly, instantly, I'm like, okay, like, let's just break down the real basics here.
It's like, why is this not already on fire?
Like, that's what it more felt like. It was like, wait, why, what? How is this already not? But the fact that there's still, like, a confusion around that, I think is then also, that's part of our system too, is like, is using the confusion to, like, hide all the things, but it's just not confusing.
Yeah.
But it's also in the chaos and in the confusion and in the hate, it's not going to build those common grounds.
Definitely.
And the fact that we are now, I think, at a point in America where we can just have those conversations, and, like, we can actually start working towards what it would look like. I think there's a lot of hope for it.
Like, I agree.
For me personally, like, I see people like myself and our age just really embracing, like, what does this look
having
like?
These conversations, like, in mass.
Yeah,
like,
in mass.
Even if it slowed down, it's still happening.
Right.
And it did happen.
Right, exactly. And so it's like, but just having, I think more people just need to just do a little bit of history research and just have a lot of empathy.
Empathy.
And being fine to get shot down, like you were just kind of talking through. Like, if I meet somebody and I'm like, yo, I want to, like, do something, and then they're just like totally shoot me down. It's just like, hey, that's just where they're at in life. That's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as they're not being, like, violent towards me, then whatever.
Yeah.
Totally get it. And like you said, move on. Go find other people and get involved there. And, like, but more people just working towards the building a bridge of empathy and understanding on both sides, which then will hopefully show, like, older generations, like, hey, it's not just the extremes on either sides.
Yes.
And there's common ground here. And although, yes, sometimes maybe somebody is screaming in your face that you're, like, a racist, or you feel like somebody is, ultimately the majority of people are just wanting you to, like, try to understand.
Yeah.
And they're not thinking you're a horrible human being who should be sentenced to death. Like, that's not what is happening here. But they're, it's just, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So much.
A lot. It's a lot. But it's, you know, we're unpacking it.
Yeah. But I mean, ultimately, I feel like, well, partly, like, before we started, it is a little bit disheartening to not hear so many people having conversations, which is so typical of our culture, where we just hopped from subject to subject to subject. And in reality, this movement was massive, so it definitely had a huge impact. It didn't just kind of, like, go and then fizzle. It sustained for quite a while. Yeah. And like you said, there are still a lot of people talking about it. So I do think a lot of good will come out of it. But there's still so much education that needs to happen on the front. And like, there's still a large portion of white people who need to put their guards down so that they can just have some empathy and understanding. And that they can realize that even if they participated, even if it's in a like halfway, because maybe they voted in something that helped. I think we all did that. Everybody in America has done that. Anyone in all of history of America has.
Yeah.
So it's not, that's what it is. It's like, you just need to not take it so personally, but we all need to just recognize and acknowledge like, hey, that's the reality. That doesn't mean we should burn America down and we hate America. It's the worst thing that's ever happened, because that also is kind of how some people feel.
Yeah.
They're just like, you hate America.
Yeah.
Why do you have to just focus on all the horrible things America's done? And it's like, that's not the point. But I'm also not going to just pretend that we're perfect and that we've never done anything wrong.
If you have a beautiful house,
yeah,
and you find out that like the foundation's falling somewhere, if we don't talk about it, the whole house will collapse. So like,
exactly,
we should talk about our shortcomings,
yes,
and our weak points. That way we can fix them before we collapse.
That's 100% it. That's the best analogy for that. So that's exactly how I feel about it.
Yeah.
It's like, of course we would. And so it's not bad to talk about the things that are bad about.
It's because I care. It's because I love the country. Care.
Yes. It's because we love America. It's because we love the things that come with our country and all of that. So it's like, that's perfect. I think that's an awesome way to wrap up that section.
Perfect. No, I'm with it.
I feel like we just like jumped in at 1,000,000%.
Yeah, we took some time. Yeah, it was great though. I mean, and it's an evolving conversation. Like, we could definitely do more conversations
on
any of it, on all of it, because there's so much to be said about lots of things.
Right.
And I enjoy talking to you, so I'm glad that we could.
Heck yeah, man. On a lighter note.
Yes, sir.
The other day you posted to your Instagram story, and my wife was watching it as you were talking about, you live by the beach now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you don't go that much because you hate sand.
Yes, I hate
And she
sand.
Started laughing so much because I always complain about the sand. And she thinks it's ridiculous. But sand is the worst.
Yeah, like I said, to be Anakin Skywalker, like right now, it's it gets everywhere. It's just horrible. It's coarse. I'm so good at embracing things, but for some reason that's always been a challenge for me, to embrace like sand. It just feels like such a, yeah. I'm glad to hear that you are also come to your senses. And
no, I've always. Understand. I think it also, like growing up doing photography and stuff, like sand is just the absolute worst thing for gear.
Damage all your equipment.
It just ruins everything. One little piece of sand gets in your lens and it's just like, and it's game over. But also, yeah, just having it all over your body is the worst. And then it's all over the house. Inevitably, it's always in the bed.
Yeah.
How did it get in the bed? The door. You took your shoes off. You jumped right into the shower.
It doesn't matter.
Change your clothes. And there is sand in the bed when you get into bed. It makes no sense.
Yeah. You get it. That's all I have to say.
I don't get how other people don't get it.
Yes.
I still go to the beach. I still love the beach.
But I love it.
Wasn't sand, it would be better.
But like, I love the softness. It's not like I want it to be asphalt. I don't want it to be
pebbles. I want it to be exactly what it is. I just don't
want
it to be
the sand to collect. Yes. Why does the sand have to stick to us? Can we make it less sticky?
Exactly.
I don't know. That is a thing. I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, that's an important part.
That's probably the most important thing that we've said today. No, I was joking. But yeah, it's that's a side campaign that I'm working on. So I'll let you sign up for that movement as well.
We'll invent something that it's your suntan lotion, but it also somehow does the opposite. It makes sand not stick to you.
Yes,
that would be amazing.
I'd be all for that.
This is the next venture. We'll go into it together.
Perfect.
Well, like you said, we could talk for another three Forever. More hours and then another whole day.
Yeah.
But I feel like that was great.
Yeah. No, me too. I'm excited for that. And I'm glad we had to talk and look forward to talking more.
Heck yeah. Also, you said you're going to be starting a podcast.
Yes.
Do you have a name and all that? No.
I know nothing. I just know that I love having these conversations about this. And I love that concept of like building bridges and I've been really fortunate, I think, like I said, from my upbringing to be around diverse opinions. And so I feel like I walk that intersection really well of like, you know, like having so many people in my life that I love that are law enforcement, and then being able to talk about this issue from both sides of that, and being able to talk about, you know, whether it's Republican, Democrat, or whether it's like vegan, anti-vegan, or any, like, I feel like I've walked a lot of both of these lines and have been really fortunate to get very deep with a lot of people on both of these. And I think that's just because I like you mentioned empathy, like empathy, I think is key to everything. It's just like being willing to understand that somebody's probably not malicious and not evil and like has a good reason for whatever, a reason they feel is good for whatever they're doing, and giving them that credit and that space allows us to find like, okay, well, where can we get along and where can we work? And so I want to have more of those conversations too.
Yeah.
And get, you know, so I haven't really, this is a new concept, you know. Unfortunately, I'm in a house that full of creatives that are pushing me to like do this.
Yeah.
So I decided to do that. And so I'll update you once that's happening.
Yeah. But for now, people could follow you on Instagram.
Instagram, Kylan Young. Yes, exactly. I'll be there. KY Land, Young. That's everything. Kylan Young is all my stuff.
Sweet. Heck yeah. Dude, that's awesome.
Thank you.
I think it's really important. We live in a time that's just insane. That you can just grab your phone even and just start recording your experiences and your thoughts. And the whole idea of everything that I'm doing is kind of predicated against that idea of empathy and building bridges through stories, though.
Stories.
Like the reason
are huge.
That I like podcasts and just like having people just be like, what was it like growing up? And like starting from there is because now the audience has empathy for you and we've built. So then when we start jumping into Black Lives Matter, instead of that being the start point, now people are like, oh, this is just like a dude. Grew up with a family.
Yeah.
Like everybody.
Yeah.
We all have these, they're different, but they're common and we connect on story. And I think story is what can actually transform people and culture ultimately. Like if we get enough people posting through social media, we can overwhelm even like the news and all these other places that are like just pumping like not empathetic stories, not like they're a machine that's making a lot of money. And so they're incentivized
to keep people passionate
to
divided.
Like beat out other people. So they're competing with one another. You don't need to compete with anybody. You can just talk about whatever you want and post it on the internet.
Very true.
That's awesome. And then guess what? There is going to be a group of people who are going to be attracted to that. They're going to listen to it. They're going to start telling people. So if you just keep doing that for a long, long period of time, then all of a sudden thousands of people, if not tens, if not potentially millions of people. And we just need way more people doing that. And it's super accessible. And people like yourself who have something to say, I think it's super important that like you start that. So I'm super excited that you're going to be starting that. I will definitely listen to it.
Thank you.
For sure. All right. That's it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Else.
No, anything.
I mean, I could. I want to keep talking.
Of course.
But we'll stop here. Thank you.
Peace.
Later, guys.